Today is Wednesday, August the 14th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Meta and Google secretly targeted minors on YouTube with Instagram ads. The companies reportedly made use of a loophole to intentionally serve ads to kids. Meta and Google teamed up to run a secret campaign that deliberately targeted 13 to 17-year-olds with Instagram ads on YouTube, according to the Financial Times, breaking the search giant's own rules against advertising to children. The publication reports that Google directed ads to a subset of users labeled as unknown in its advertising systems in an attempt to disguise the group skewed toward teenagers. According to a Google Ads help page, the unknown demographic category refers to people whose age, gender, parental status, or household income are supposedly unidentified and can allow advertisers to reach a significant wider audience when selected. Instagram and Facebook face European Union probe of child addiction. However, Google could use app downloads and online activity to determine with a high degree of confidence that the unknown group was populated by younger users, reports the Financial Times. Google staffers are said to have used this loophole to get around the company's own policies, having introduced rules that block ad targeting based on age, gender, or interest of people under 18 back in 2021. Spark Foundry, a U.S.-based subsidiary of the ad giant Publicis, reportedly worked with the companies to launch the illicit marketing campaign in Canada between February and April this year, before going on to trial the program in the United States in May. Meta and Google intended to expand the campaign to international markets and promote additional services like Facebook, according to the Financial Times. The program was initiated amid a decline in Google's advertising earnings and the migration of Meta's younger users to rival services like TikTok. Google has since launched an investigation into the allegations, and the campaign has now been canceled, the Financial Times reports. We prohibit ads being personalized to people under 18, period, Google said in a statement to the publication. We'll also be taking additional action to reinforce with sales representatives that they must not help advertisers or agencies run campaigns attempting to work around our policies. Microsoft will axe the Paint 3D app November the 4th, 2024. It will be removed from the Microsoft Store, cementing classic Windows Paint's revival. Paint 3D, which was once billed as the modernized replacement of the classic Microsoft Paint app, is, ironically, getting the axe just 7 years after its launch. Some users who opened the app have found a banner under the toolbar saying, Paint 3D won't be available in the Microsoft Store or receive future updates starting on November the 4th, 2024. Microsoft built the Paint 3D app with a focus on 3D modeling. But aside from that, it also introduced layers, transparency effects, background removal, PNG support, and more. However, Windows Central reports that the users were up in arms when the company attempted to replace the classic Microsoft Paint app with the new 3D Focus version. This forced Microsoft to allow both versions to become available on Windows 10 and Windows 11. Although Paint 3D has more features than classic Paint, many users still prefer the latter to its simplicity, ease of use, and launch speed. And by the way, my choice was the classic Paint when I needed. In 2023, Microsoft gave the classic Paint app some major upgrades. These included layers, transparency, and auto background removal, features that used to be exclusive to Paint 3D. Aside from this massive update, Microsoft Paint also received an AI superpower with the co-creator feature, available only to Microsoft Copilot users. With the classic Paint app getting all these upgrades, it seems Paint 3D wasn't getting any love from its developers. Furthermore, the 3D features available to the newer app didn't really become a mainstream hit. Due to these reasons, it's probably made sense for Microsoft to just combine the most in-demand features of Paint 3D with Microsoft Paint and simply discontinue the former. After all, it's only launched in 2017, whereas the original Microsoft Paint was launched in 1985, nearly 40 years ago. Microsoft Paint itself was a licensed version of PC Paintbrush created by ZSoft Corporation, which Microsoft bundled with Windows 1.0. Because of its age, simplicity, ease of use, and nostalgia, many users are still in love with Microsoft Paint. The company has continuously been updating and adding more features to this simple raster graphics editor, while cannot compete with the power and feature set of advanced apps like GIMP and Adobe Photoshop. The fact that it comes free with Windows and does a job for most users make it a crucial app within the Microsoft ecosystem. Windows wouldn't be Windows without Microsoft Paint, and I totally agree with that. CrowdStrike revealed root cause of the global Microsoft meltdown. Company says outage caused by a single sensor error. CrowdStrike, the cybersecurity company at the center of last month's Microsoft meltdown, has claimed that a single sensor error led to the worldwide outage. More than 8 million Microsoft users reported on July the 19th that their computers wouldn't turn on, with monitors showing the blue screen of death. The outage caused widespread chaos as television stations went offline, air travel was disrupted, and hospitals were forced to cancel appointments. In a preliminary report soon after, CrowdStrike claimed the outage was caused by a faulty update to its Falcon sensor. The Falcon platform has wide access to computers sitting at the kernel level of the Windows operating system and is supposed to analyze a range of sensors to protect systems from malicious software and hackers. It works by examining a range of indicators in a computer to check for signs of suspicious activity. Now, in a more comprehensive root cause analysis, CrowdStrike claimed the meltdown was caused by just one undetected sensor. It's called the bug Channel 291 incident. CrowdStrike changes the location or the number of sensors it checks for potential attacks when it updates the Falcon system. The global Microsoft outage stranded passengers at many airports, as reported by the Associated Press. When the faulty update was rolled out on July the 19th, Falcon expected the system to have 20 input fields, but it had 21 instead. This count mismatch flooded the memory of systems and led to the global Microsoft crash. Investors sued CrowdStrike over global outage, loss of $25 million. The content interpreter expected only 20 values, the report explains, meaning the bug sent computers in a tailspin trying to look for the source of the extra data that simply wasn't there. Therefore, the attempt to access the 21st value produced an out-of-bounds memory read
beyond the end of the input data array and resulted in a systems crash. I asked a simple question. Was this ever tested? And if it was tested, how much thorough testing was done? The public is not expected to be the testbed for production systems.
Last Saturday on August the 10th, at the DEF CON Black Hat Conference, CrowdStrike accepts award for the most epic fail after global IT outage. Just a few weeks after its software update triggered a global IT meltdown, CrowdStrike isn't shying away from the spotlight. In fact, the company's president, Michael Sentonas, even took the stage at the Pony Awards to accept the award for the most epic fail. The awards took place at the DEF CON right after the Black Hat Conference, where CrowdStrike had one of the biggest booths, giving out free t-shirts and action figures. A spokesperson told TechCrunch that the company's message to attendees was one of gratitude and appreciation for the Black Hat community. Footage of Sentonas' acceptance speech had been shared online, similar to the conference attendees who seemed willing to give CrowdStrike a second chance. The award audience sounded enthusiastic and appreciative of Sentonas for showing up to acknowledge the company's mistakes. The organizers explained that this final award was a last-minute switch because how could CrowdStrike not win? Then, as a comically large trophy was brought on stage to loud cheers, Sentonas admitted, "This is definitely not the award to be proud of receiving. I think the team was surprised when I said straight away that I would get it," Sentonas continued, "because we got this horribly wrong. We said this a number of different times, and it's super important to own it when you do things well, and it's super important to own it when you do things horribly wrong." Sentonas said he'd be taking the trophy back to CrowdStrike headquarters and displaying it in a prominent place as a reminder that our goal is to protect people, and we got this wrong, and I want to make sure everybody understands these things cannot happen. And the following is a recording of the speech he made.
I think these are too small. I think we need another. I think we might need a different award. You can open the envelope if we need to.
Can I put it down there?
Yeah.
Big trophy. Hey everyone, Mike Sentonas, president of CrowdStrike. Definitely not the award to be proud of receiving, but I think the team was surprised when I said straight away that I'd come and get it, because we got this horribly wrong. We've said that a number of different times, and it's super important to own it when you do things well. It's super important to own it when you do things horribly wrong, which we did in this case. The reason why I wanted the trophy is I'm heading back to headquarters. I'm going to take the trophy with me. It's going to sit pride of place, because I want every CrowdStriker who comes to work to see it, because, you know, our goal is to protect people, and we got this wrong, and I want to make sure that everybody understands these things can't happen, and that's what this community is about. So from that perspective, I will say thank you, and I will take the trophy, and we'll put it in the right place, and make sure everybody sees it. So thank you.
We applaud CrowdStrike's president, Michael Sentonas, for publicly owning up to a major screw-up at the DEF CON Black Hat Conference. Perhaps other government and industry leaders have taken notice and follow suit to own up to management failures. Google is no longer making Chromecasts and will let the inventory run out. The first Chromecast was announced in July of 2013 with the goal of letting people stream content from phones to televisions with the launch of the Google TV Streamer. Chromecasts are no longer being manufactured. The Chromecast with Google TV 4K and HD will remain on sale until inventory runs out. But Google is not replenishing stock after that. Google will continue to support all existing Chromecast devices with ongoing updates. At the I.O. 2024 convention, Google detailed a home runtime that allows the Android-powered dongle to act as a hub for Matter devices. That update is coming later this year. After the original in 2013, Google released a second generation in 2015 along with the Chromecast Audio. The Chromecast Ultra arrived a year later with the third generation launching in 2018. 2 years after that, the Chromecast with Google TV 4K arrived, and that was followed by the high-def version in 2022. Google no longer believes people need or necessarily want cheap streaming devices. When the Chromecast came into existence in 2013, smart TVs had not yet proliferated. Now every television has basic streaming and casting functionality. Google started changing its strategy in 2020. Not only did Chromecast with Google TV add a remote that people were clamoring for, but a full operating system focused on surfacing and recommending content. The Google TV Streamer solidifies and finalizes that shift. That said, Google not having a sub-$100 streaming device is unexpected, with the gap between the upcoming $99 device and the $29 Chromecast with Google TV HD Stark. The company's effectively not competing in that market right now. It remains to be seen whether Google will end up reassessing in the future and making a cheaper streamer with the dongle form factor inherently well suited for that. Boeing and NASA tussle over plan to bring Starliner astronauts home. The astronauts flew to orbit on Boeing's Starliner spacecraft are waiting for NASA and the company to determine whether it will get them home. Boeing has vouched for the craft. Not everyone at NASA is convinced, according to people close to the discussions, and the agency is working on backup plans that depend on SpaceX. Barry Wilmore and Sunita Williams have been aboard the International Space Station since June the 6th, when they became the first astronauts to fly in Boeing's Starliner vehicle. The temporary failure of several thrusters and discovery of helium leaks in the ship's propulsion system turned the planned week-long visit to the ISS into an extended stay. Tensions between Boeing and some NASA leaders surfaced recently when officials couldn't agree on using Starliner to take Wilmore and Williams back, and a detailed review of Starliner's readiness for the flight back was postponed, according to people familiar with the situation. The mission originally was planned to last 8 days. It has dragged out as NASA and Boeing officials assess problems with the thrusters and leaks, and what kinds of risks they might pose. Engineers have been studying both for weeks. Boeing believes that Starliner is ready to fly. The company issued a statement last week describing the in-orbit and the on-ground testing that it and NASA have conducted. It is possible that Boeing won't be permitted to try to bring Wilmore and Williams back to Earth on Starliner. Instead, NASA may call on SpaceX to handle the mission's last leg. That possibility has been discussed during recent NASA briefings. The agency is keeping all options on the table, a person familiar with NASA discussion said. NASA turning to SpaceX to complete the mission would be a tough outcome for Boeing, which has deep ties to NASA that date to the Apollo moon landings. NASA said last week that the agency and company continue to evaluate Starliner's readiness and no final decision has been made about its return. Starliner's launch in June with the two NASA's astronauts on board was celebrated by current and former space executives at Boeing, some who had spent a good part of their recent professional lives preparing the vehicle for the high stakes of transporting astronauts in space. Wilmer and Williams have been following NASA and Boeing's work on the challenges with Starliner, conducting scientific research and servicing equipment during their unexpected longest stay on ISS. The space station has plenty of food and supplies. The astronauts, both experienced former military pilots, have traveled to the space station before. Last month expressed confidence in Starliner. Failure is not an option. That's why we are staying here, Wilmer told reporters during a July press conference from the ISS. Starliner has flown twice before on test missions without anything on board. Boeing has struggled with software, valves, and other problems with the spacecraft. Last week, the company recorded a $125 million loss related to the Starliner program, according to a securities filing, adding to the roughly $1.4 billion in losses it previously recorded.
Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how they all intertwine. This week, I want to focus on something that is, well, if you look at it initially, it seems kind of disturbing. The news came out last week that Intel is planning a layoff. What seems to be a massive layoff, 15,000 jobs. It's about 15% of their total workforce, and this is going to be around the world, and they're going to be doing these layoffs between now and the end of the year, and they're going to probably, we hope, follow all of the different rules that they have to for severance pay and things like that. They're a big company. They can't afford not to. But this does raise that specter in our minds. What's going on? Is this something big? Well, it's 15% of their workforce. And Microsoft is doing their usual amount of layoffs. They do this on a regular basis. UKG, which is a software firm, they're laying off about 14% of their employees, about 2,200. And Intuit, well, they've cut some of their positions as well, about 10% of their workforce. If you do a deep dive, if you look at this over the years, a lot of companies will cut about 10% of their employees every year. There's this age-old idea in the mind of the bigwigs. They learned this in college or somewhere like this. A matter of if you trim 10%, you're trimming the fat. And then you go and you hire in more employees in the following months into similar positions, not the exact same position because that would violate layoff rules. And so forth and so on. There's a lot of different things. But I wanted to really put your mind to rest. This is a recurring situation. Now, if you are somebody who you think you're going to be laid off, you hear something like this, I do want you to be thinking, no, I don't want you to think about this then. I want you to think about this all the time. I'm going to give you some of my guidance about what I am constantly doing, and I've done this for years. You basically want to plan on a very regular basis. We're talking at least a few times a year. You should be sitting down and you should be evaluating what happens if I lose my job tomorrow. So let's unpack that for a moment. Let's think about that. Do you have all of the information about what you've done with the company you've worked for the past year, 2 years, 10 years? If you don't, you should be documenting that regularly. You should be making note of all of the good things in your reviews. You should be making notes of all of the different successes that you have made along the way. You should be plotting out every single thing that will help you in getting a new job. How many employees were affected positively by the project that you delivered? Great. Mark that down. How much money did you bring into the company? Great. Mark that down. How much did you save? How much did you, whatever it is, you want to always be updating your resume with the latest and greatest successes that you have within your job. On top of that, you should also be planning on putting away a little bit of money every month. I'm not talking about your 401k. I'm not talking about retirement. I'm talking about what are you going to do if you lose your job tomorrow. So if you haven't been doing this, good time to start. You should have your emergency fund. There's many different ways that people throughout the financial world will talk about this, but you should be able to manage quite well. This is your plan. Manage to be able to survive across the board for 3 months, 6 months. The older you get, even up to a year. Now, put all of those monies into good places that are easily accessed. Think of good CDs that are spread out regularly. Put that money where it's going to be making you some money. Now, this is on top of your 401k and various other items that you've got going on. We should always be saving money. We should always be planning in case something comes along. And I know that's hard for some people. It takes discipline. It takes real that stick-to-itiveness. I don't know how else to describe it. You need to be able to put aside all of the different fun that you want to have. Oh, great, I've got an extra $2,000 here. I'm going to splurge on myself. Don't do that. You need to be prepared regularly. Look, building up your resume is investing in your future. Putting money into the bank is building up your future. And keeping an ear to the ground, paying attention to the job you have, is also investing in your future with the company you're working for. Look, I have heard of rumors of layoffs at various companies I've worked for, and I've looked at it and I said, look, I can get all just down in the dumps about the fact that this axe could be looming over me. But the reality is, if you keep going and you keep working hard, you can at least say you did your best. You did your best job, and you can go away with your head held high. Sure, if you do get cut, look into what severance agreements, severance packages might be coming along. See if you can bargain a little bit. See if you can get a little bit more, things like that. But don't panic. Don't worry. Because each of those companies that has those massive layoffs will also be hiring more people soon enough. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The domino effects of Intel laying off 15,000. In 2024, the tech industry has experienced a significant number of layoffs, reflecting ongoing shifts and challenges within the sector. Here's a summary of the extent of tech layoffs in 2024 based on the provided search results. More than 300,000 workers at U.S.-based tech companies have been laid off in mass job cuts since the start of 2022, with the cuts continuing into 2024. This figure underscores the widespread nature of the layoffs across the tech industry. As of the end of July of this year, some 380 tech companies have laid off 109,049 employees in 2024, according to layoffs.fyi, which tracks job cuts in the tech industry. This further highlights the scale of job losses within the tech sector during this year. The number of tech sector layoffs in 2024 has been outpacing the number of terminations in 2023. With an average of more than 780 layoffs each day in 2024. This trend indicates a notable increase in job losses within the tech industry compared to previous years. The volume of layoffs in 2023 surpassed that of 2022, and the trend has continued into 2024 with a significant number of tech companies implementing workforce reductions. This suggests a sustained period of job cuts within the tech sector. The data indicates that the tech industry
has experienced a substantial number of layoffs in 2024 with a significant impact on the workforce. Intel recently announced a significant downsizing of its workforce with plans to lay off over 15,000 employees as part of a new $10 billion cost savings plan for 2025. This represents a reduction of greater than 15% of its workforce, which currently consists of over 125,000 employees. The layoffs are expected to have a substantial impact on the company and its operations. Intel intends to reduce R&D and marketing, as well as general spending, to achieve its cost-saving goals. The company also plans to reduce capital expenditures by more than 20% in 2024. These measures are part of Intel's multi-year transformation strategy, which aims to realign its cost structure with its new operating model. The layoffs were attributed to unused manufacturing capacity and charges associated with its launch of its AI PCs. Intel CEO Gelsinger expressed that the news of the layoffs were painful for him to share, indicating the difficult decision the company had to make. The layoffs at Intel are significant not only for the company, but also for the broader industry and economy. The announcement of such a large-scale layoff by one of the nation's largest chip makers is seen as a troubling sign, particularly in the context of the Biden administration efforts to revitalize U.S. chip manufacturing. The layoffs at Intel are expected to have far-reaching effects on the company, its employees, and the industry as a whole. The company's efforts to realign its cost structure and adapt to changing market conditions will likely continue to shape its future trajectory. The impact of Intel's recent layoffs extends beyond the company itself, with implications for the industry and the broader economy. The decision to lay off over 15,000 employees, representing a reduction of greater than 15% of its workforce, is part of a new $10 billion cost-saving plan for 2025. This significant downsizing is expected to have far-reaching effects. The layoffs at Intel are seen as a troubling sign, particularly in the context of the Biden administration's effort to revitalize U.S. chip manufacturing. The announcement of such a large-scale layoff by one of the nation's largest chip makers is a setback for these efforts. Analysts have expressed concerns about the impact of the layoffs on Intel's future trajectory. While the cost-cutting plan may bolster its near-term financials, it is seen as insufficient to redefine its position in the evolving chip market. There are hopes that the company will be strategic in its approach to the layoffs, and not just across the board, but which could make it harder to execute and invest in strategic areas. Intel is facing a lawsuit that accuses the company of lying to shareholders about the state of its in-house chips manufacturing business ahead of the reported net loss and mass layoff of 15,000 jobs. This legal challenge adds another layer of complexity to the situation. The layoffs at Intel are expected to have a significant impact not only on the company and its employees, but also on the industry and the broader economy. The bloom of AI hype appears to be fading, as evidenced by various indicators and industry sentiments. According to company earnings, calls over the past two quarters, the number of times that the word AI, machine learning, or generative AI were mentioned decreased significantly, from 517 instances in the fourth quarter of last year to just 198 in the first quarter of this year. This decline suggests a normalization of the hype around artificial intelligence, reflecting a potential shift in industry focus and sentiment. Discussions on platforms like Reddit indicate a sense of disillusionment with the AI hype. Users have expressed feelings that the excitement around AI is waning, with some noting that the technology is becoming a normal extension of their tools rather than a groundbreaking novelty. Governments and regulatory bodies are actively debating how to regulate AI, signaling a shift from the initial hype to a more practical consideration of the technology's implications and potential risk. Additionally, industry analysts have suggested that 2024 is a pivotal year for generative AI to move beyond experimentation to implementation, indicating a transition from hype to tangible action. Analysts have noted that the AI hype faded somewhat by the fourth quarter of last year and they anticipate that companies will begin to turn talk into action in 2024. This suggests a shift from speculative excitement to a more pragmatic approach to AI implementation and development. Overall, the evidence of various sources points to a trend of diminishing AI hype with a growing focus on practical implementations, regulatory considerations, and a more tempered industry outlook.
What is the difference between USB-C and USB-C PD cable? Well, there are cables and there are cables. Tech companies have been trying to standardize connections between computers and their peripherals, mice, keyboards, scanners, and the like, for decades. But when you're frantically searching for the old box of cables for one weird shape needed by a specific device, standardization seems more of a stretch than a reality. USB, universal serial bus, emerged in the late 1990s as the agreed-upon standard for data transfer between devices and their peripherals. It's had staying power, if not universal connectivity. Those cords in the box, lots of them are probably early USB. Enter USB-C. If you have a laptop, tablet, or Android phone, you're familiar with this newest USB port and plug. USB-C doesn't just handle data, though. Today, USB technology delivers power, too, and lots of it. Can those old cords finally be retired? Well, it depends. When we think of a USB plug or port, we tend to think about what it looks like, and it turns out that's exactly what we should be doing. USB types are categorized by their shape. The familiar flat rectangular shaped USB port that's been on the backs of computers for decades is called USB Type A or USB-A. USB standards, also called specifications, deal with the underlying technological capabilities of USB. Data transfer speeds and power delivery. The first data standard was, obviously, USB 1.0, and the latest is USB 4.0, with multiple revisions in between. The latest power delivery standard is USB PD, that's dash PD, revision 3.1. Every device, cable, plug, or port that uses USB technology is a specific type like USB-C and performs to specific standards like USB 4 and USB PD. Well, what is USB-C? USB-C is a connection type that puts the universal in USB, oblong and symmetrical. There's no right way or wrong way to plug them in. The cables are bidirectional too. It doesn't matter which end goes to which device. Data and current can travel in either direction. Ease of use is a great perk, but performance is often the bigger driver of tech adoption. USB-C has much greater data and power transmission capability than previous USB types, and it supports multiple kinds of data, even non-USB data like HDMI. Devices that don't use HSB-C yet, such as iPhones, will soon be forcibly dragged into the USB-C family, at least in Europe. The European Union Parliament will require USB-C charging capability on all small and medium-sized devices by the end of this year. What is USB power delivery? USB power delivery, or USB-PD, is a USB charging specification that maximizes the available power delivered to a device. When people talk about fast charging technology, that's USB-PD. The latest USB-PD standard can deliver 240 watts power is measured in watts to devices that can handle it. That's a huge leap over the previous spec, which maxed out at 100 watts. Just because a charger can deliver 240 watts does not mean a device needs all that juice or that a cable can handle it. It's important that a power delivery system does not just blast out the max power to whatever happens to be plugged in. Headphones don't need the same wattage as a laptop.
USB-PD allows devices to communicate with each other before transmitting and receiving power so they can take and or deliver only what is needed. Can USB-PD run on USB-C cables? Absolutely. The latest generation of USB-PD puts out max power only when paired with the latest USB-C technology. But not all USB-C cables and ports can handle USB-P. Are you confused yet? Well, think of it like this. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. When the USB Implementers Forum, that's the USB governing body, released new standards, they did not confiscate the old stuff. In other words, they tried to keep it backwards compatible. It still works. It's just using a slightly less powerful tech, and it will be limited to the speed and power that it's already capable of. So if you buy the latest USB-PD charger, but don't buy the newest version USB-C cable, you won't be getting the charger's max output. Likewise, if the device you want to charge can't handle the max output, it won't accept it. Do you need new chargers and cables? Only if you want or need to take advantage of the faster speeds and power capabilities, and only if your device can handle the latest fast charging technology. Verify that your device is compatible before investing in USB-PD chargers. Can USB-C power delivery charge older devices? Yes. Power delivery chargers are backward compatible, meaning they will charge older devices as long as they each have the same USB-C connection type. But again, you will only get the power delivery that the older device can accept. Can USB-C power delivery charge older devices? Yes. Power delivery charges are backward compatible, meaning they will charge older devices as long as they each have the same USB connection type. But again, you will only get the power delivery that the older device can accept. Well, there's a problem. How do you differentiate between a USB-C and a USB-PD cable when there is no labeling? It's challenging to differentiate them solely based on appearance. There are some indications to look out for. If the USB-C cable is sold in a package, check the packaging or product description. Many manufacturers indicate whether the cable supports data transfer, power delivery, or both. Look for details such as USB 3.1, USB 3.2, or USB 4 for data transfer capabilities. Data cables typically support both data transfer and power delivery and are marked with these standards. USB-PD allows devices to communicate with each other before transmitting and receiving power, so they can take and or deliver only what is needed. Not all USB-C cables and ports can handle USB-PD, so it's important to ensure compatibility. If the USB-C cable is sold without any packaging or specification sheet, don't assume it is a USB-PD cable. You can test if it is a USB-PD cable with a known device that needs power from the cable, but this is only possible after you made the purchase. Testing present inventory of USB-C cables with devices known to support data transfer can provide insight into their capabilities. If they are USB-PD compliant, label them in some manner and set them aside for needed use when recommended. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston is joining me now, and we're going to talk about, what are we going to talk about?
Well, let's talk about home automation for a minute.
Okay, sure.
I'm not talking because when you have home automation, you have to be very careful about what you say.
Oh, it listens to everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then it sometimes has very smart answers for you. And I'm not talking intelligent either.
One of the challenges with home automation
Yes.
is that it's ugly. And guys, if you don't believe me, ask your spouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. All of those little wall warts that you plug in the power cord into the wall wart, and then plug the wall wart into the wall.
And don't forget about the little things that allow the wire to crawl up the wall as if you've got weeds coming out of the carpet, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of that, too.
Anyway, the traditional, better-looking – remember when wall switches were toggles? Click, 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 click. And you thought, hey, that's pretty normal. And then those flat rockers came out.
Yes.
Leviton, a giant in that. They called theirs Decora.
Yeah.
It is actually, I
have no idea if that's like a Kleenex thing where everybody refers to Kleenex, even though Kleenex is the only one who owns the brand name. Yeah. But it's throughout the industry.
Well, that's how aspirin lost its trademark. It used to belong to one company way back when.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And Kleenex and Xerox and others have had quite the same phenomenon.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, the odds are, if we were to tally up every switch in every home of every listener, that you folks, there would be a lot more made by Leviton than by anyone else. Mm-hmm. Leviton has they have the advantage of time. They've been around forever. They have a huge installed base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, not a great surprise. Little wonder. Some of their recent products are for people who want to keep home automation simple. Mm-hmm. And yet, not ugly. And one great example, their new Leviton Decora Smart Outdoor Plug-in Switch. It has a short wire with a three-prong plug, a short wire with a three-prong outlet, and in between, a small box with some smarts in it. So if you have some outdoor lights or a fountain or almost anything else electric you want to be able to turn on and off, either at will or automatically or through automation.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, you can use the My Leviton app or Matter or IFTTT, if this then that, which is called IFTTT, over Wi-Fi. And you can extend those through Apple Home or Google Home or Alexa. Or if you're old school, it has an on-off button you can push. Now, when that thing's outside, you can get the app to do it. But if you want to power something with extra demand, like pumps or things with starters, magnetic ballast, right? Check the specs for their special limits. But for normal things, this is a 15-watt remote-controlled outlet. It's about $55.
Yeah, all right.
Now, for those homes who have a family member who doesn't want to have to poke at a handset to turn things on and off, well, check out the new Leviton Decora. That's that nice flat rocker switch. Look, Smart Anywhere Switch Companion. It's less than $30.
Okay.
You can literally mount it anywhere because it doesn't have to be on an electrical box.
Ooh. Okay. Ooh, okay.
There's no wiring to do because it gets its power from a pair of coin cells that claim a 5-year life expectancy. That's the Decora Smart Outdoor Switch. And it's just one of several switches and dimmers that it can control.
Okay, so that is that 5 years. That's
cool.
That's cool off of some coin cells. We're starting to get in that direction where batteries are. We're getting a lot better life out of them because of. I mean, I've got two AA's powering each of the cameras in my house.
Yeah.
And they're lasting anywhere from 9 months to a year.
Even longer if you got a solar panel on them.
Yeah. I remember when, you get a video game and those, you'd have four AA batteries sticking into that thing and it would give you maybe 2 days. I remember the Merlin had just a few days out of that.
By the day after Christmas, most families will have gone through three sets of batteries on the toys that got unwrapped.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
battery technology is getting better. I love that. I love the usage of the power has just improved immensely.
And now that we have started to do away with ugly, now that we've started doing away with the babysitting, Mm-hmm. And now that we're not dealing with things that are handicapped in their ability to handle big loads, suddenly it's starting to go mainstream.
Yes, very much so.
Well, that's Leviton. Mm-hmm. And there's the Chorus Smart outdoor plug-in and switch. And by the way, I put mine on, among other things, the homebrew heater that wraps around the drain spout on my condensing outdoor water heater.
Nice.
So it won't freeze in the winter. All right. It's still there with the thermostat. It's not going to draw power when it's not cold enough. But when it is, I don't have to worry about having to replace the thing just because all of its heat exchangers crack.
Yeah. Very nice. You know, this is one story that you've had that just keeps giving and giving and giving.
So there it we does go. Indeed. As long as it doesn't take again.
Oh, dear. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, August the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect. Tuesday, September the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. In-person general meetings are back. Scarsdale Public Library, 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York. Zip code 10583. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. WPCUG.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. King's Bike Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.